From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, we examine the recent revolution in Romania and the independence movement in Lithuania with journalist Robert Cullen. He's a former Newsweek Moscow correspondent and writes about the Soviet Union for The Atlantic and The New Yorker. Also today, the Australian-born political cartoonist Pat Oliphant talks about caricaturing American presidents. The National Portrait Gallery has just kicked off a 25-year retrospective of Oliphant's work. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album from The Shoes, a band from Illinois that Ken says makes great albums that no one ever hears. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev told a delegation of U.S. senators today that he's determined to have a framework for an arms control agreement ready for approval in time for next month's superpower summit. Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell and six other senators met with Gorbachev today in Moscow. Mitchell told reporters that the Soviet president stressed that he wants to make enough progress on a treaty cutting long-range nuclear weapons to allow the pact to be initialed at the May 30th summit. In Iraq, President Hussein has told a group of visiting U.S. senators that his country is ready to dismantle its weapons of mass destruction if Israel does the same. The five senators, led by Minority Leader Robert Dole, are on a trip to the Middle East and arrived in Iraq to hear Hussein's side in the dispute over Iraq's weapons development. Mike Theodoulou has this report.
The statement issued by the Foreign Minister, Tariq Aziz, was a challenge to what the Arab world sees as the West's hypocrisy. Why, Iraq asks, is there an outcry against us for developing chemical weapons, but no criticism of Israel, which is believed to have nuclear weapons? Robert Dole told reporters his meeting with the Iraqi president was excellent, but he gave no details. The U.S. delegation went to Iraq to hear Saddam Hussein's side in the weapons dispute at the very time the row was deepening. Military experts say Iraqi-bound steel casings seized by British customs officials yesterday could be used for a giant cannon. Iraq has vehemently denied this, insisting that it is part of a continuing Western plot inspired by Israel to discredit Iraq. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodoulou in Nicosia.
Defense Secretary Dick Cheney said today that he expects to send Congress a list of recommended cuts in some or all of four major aircraft programs within a matter of weeks. Cheney told the U.S. Navy League that the cuts could include the controversial B-2 stealth bomber, the C-17 cargo plane, and advanced tactical fighter planes for the Navy and Air Force. A jury in Elizabeth, New Jersey, has convicted John List on five counts of first-degree murder for killing his family 18 years ago. Dick Hinchliffe of member station WNYC has this report.
It took the jury just 9 hours over 2 days of deliberations to return with the most severe verdict of first-degree murder against a man who shot his wife, mother, and three teenage children, then started a new life, remarrying and using another name. List was picked up by authorities in Virginia last June after the multiple murder case was featured on the TV show America's Most Wanted. The 64-year-old Sunday school teacher and accountant showed no emotion as the guilty verdicts were read. The jury rejected defense arguments that List was compelled by religious obsession and believed he was saving his children from a life of poverty. Under New Jersey law, first-degree murder carries a mandatory life sentence with possible parole after 15 years. List is scheduled to be sentenced May 1st. For National Public Radio, I'm Dick Hinchliffe in New York.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed at 2,721. This is NPR. Violence broke out last night in Teaneck, New Jersey, during a candlelight memorial for a black youth shot and killed by a white police officer. Police say gangs of youths broke away from the mourners and rioted, overturning a police cruiser and other cars, looting stores, and smashing the front door of the police station. Local NAACP Chief George Powell blamed the trouble on people from outside the town and the presence of a large number of police in riot gear. The former governor of West Virginia, Arch Moore, has agreed to plead guilty to a 5-count indictment charging him with extortion, mail and tax fraud, and obstruction of justice. Beth Voorhees of West Virginia Public Radio reports.
Arch Moore admitted committing illegal acts relating to his 1984 election campaign, his term of governor from 1984 to 1988, and his 1988 re-election campaign. He also admitted blocking a federal grand jury's investigation of him in 1989 and 1990. U.S. Attorney Michael Carey, who has been successful in obtaining convictions from several state politicians in the past year, said it's a sad day for West Virginia.
It's a tragedy. An official of his stature was involved in political corruption. I hope it will serve as a deterrent to anybody else, whether a high or low-level official that might be contemplating criminal conduct.
The former governor faces up to 36 years in prison and a fine of over $1 million. He'll be sentenced at a later date. For National Public Radio, I'm Beth Voorhees in Charleston, West Virginia.
The first family paid more than $100,000 in federal income taxes for 1989 on earnings of almost $460,000. President Bush and his wife Barbara reported more than $200,000 in earnings from business holdings kept in a blind trust. That, added to the president's government salary and other income, put the first family close to the half-million mark. The Bush's income tax return was made public today. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Robert Cullen was in Lithuania on March 11th when the Republic declared its independence from the Soviet Union. Cullen was in Romania in January, just after the overthrow of the Ceausescu regime. Cullen is writing a book on the changing shape of the Soviet Empire. He's a former Moscow correspondent for Newsweek and more recently has been writing about the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe for The Atlantic and The New Yorker. We invited him to share his analysis of the revolution in Romania and the independence movement in Lithuania. This week, Mikhail Gorbachev warned that redrawing the boundaries of the Soviet Union would lead to civil war and bloody carnage. Lithuania was annexed by the Soviets 50 years ago and was turned into one of the 15 republics that make up the Soviet Union. I asked Cullen why Lithuania became the first republic to assert its independence.
I think the major reason is that Lithuania has a more homogeneous population than either of the other two Baltic republics. Somewhere between 80 and 85% of the population of Lithuania is Lithuanian, and that figure is only about 60 to 65% for Estonia and barely 50% for Latvia. So the Lithuanians had a stronger popular mandate for independence than either of the other two republics, and therefore they went first.
You were in Lithuania, I believe, when its independence was declared?
That's right.
I'm sure you spoke to a lot of people. You were there. Can you give us a sense of some of the reasons that people in the nationalist movement gave you for their fervor?
Well, there are reasons that go back 40 and 50 years. Some of the members of the Sąjūdis movement, which is the name of the independence movement in Lithuania, were children when the Soviets first moved into Lithuania in 1940. And they remember parents or relatives being deported. One man that I spoke to in a high position in Sąjūdis had both of his parents deported to Siberia, and he and his brothers and sisters had to more or less fend for themselves for several years before his parents were able to make their way back from Siberia to Lithuania. They saw their economy fall far behind the economies of the Scandinavian countries to which they like to compare themselves. They saw enormous losses in terms of freedom to say and do what they wanted. They suffered a great deal. One man who is the deputy chairman of the Presidium of the new Lithuanian Supreme Soviet had relatives who joined the guerrilla forces, which fought against the Soviets for about 6 or 7 years after World War II, and remembers bodies being thrown on the steps of the church in his village when the KGB forces would catch some of the guerrillas, and remembers how the people were afraid to claim the bodies of their relatives because they knew that people who showed themselves to be relatives of guerrillas would be likely to be deported to Siberia. So the bodies just sat there and festered. Those kinds of experiences don't leave people's consciousnesses very easily, and they breed a tremendous longing for independence. And that's the basic motivation, I think, for the Lithuanian Declaration of Independence, and that's why they're so fervent about it. As far as the immediate causes for their declaration, I think there are two or three things. One is that the Lithuanian leadership is not very politically experienced. Most of them are intellectuals. A lot of them are physicists. Vytautas Landsberg is a musicologist. They haven't had any experience in politics, and as a result, I think they tend to look at their situation in a very legalistic way, as if this affair were going to be settled in the long run by the world court, so that they feel that they constitute the legitimate government of Lithuania, which had its sovereignty interrupted but not taken away in 1940, and therefore, as soon as they were able to convene the new legislature after the last elections, they felt it within their power and their right to declare independence. I don't think they understand or appreciate the political situation that they're in and the need to try to work out some kind of politically acceptable deal with the Soviets that would give those in the Soviet government who would not want to block independence if they had to make the choice, some kind of face-saving way to give it to the Lithuanians. And so I think that they have also, I should mention that they were afraid at the time that when Mikhail Gorbachev was given his new title of president and new presidential powers, that he would use those powers immediately to stifle the results of the last election in Lithuania, to declare presidential rule or martial law, and to prevent them from convening as a group, so that they felt some urgency. They convened quickly, they declared their independence, or they restored their independence, as they would say, and they acted in a way that, while it may have been legally and technically correct, at least in their own minds, politically may not have been as astute as it should have been.
If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Robert Cullen, and he's been writing about Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union for The Atlantic and New Yorker magazines. He was a Moscow correspondent for Newsweek magazine and has a forthcoming novel based on his experiences there. When you were in Lithuania, you were not only exposed to strong nationalist feelings, but you met some people who had been in the nationalist movement and had grown skeptical of it. Would you explain their reasons for skepticism?
Well, there are quite a few Lithuanians who are disturbed by some of the, what they call, anti-democratic tendencies within Sąjūdis. For example, I had a long talk with Vytis Tomkus, who is the editor of a new newspaper in Lithuania called Respublika, which is a very freewheeling, slightly yellow even, daily newspaper that he began with backing from Sąjūdis. He now feels it normal and right to criticize some of the Sąjūdis leadership. His newspaper has been roundly criticized and condemned as a communist organ by the leadership of Sąjūdis as a result of his being critical of some of the Sąjūdis leaders. In other words, in his view, they don't really understand the principle of plurality of opinion. There are some other examples. I had some long conversations with a man named Arvydas Juozaitis, who's an extremely interesting person. He was the first Soviet male swimmer ever to win an Olympic medal. This was at the Montreal Olympics in 1976. And he agonized over whether he should wear a Lithuanian jacket on the victory stand in an effort to do what Tommy Smith and John Carlos did for the black movement at the 1968 Olympics in Mexico City. In the end, he decided he couldn't afford to do that because his parents might lose their jobs and he might lose his chance for an education. And he learned the lesson that an individual can't stand up to the Soviet government, but perhaps an organization can. And he was active 12 years later in the founding of Sąjūdis. But when I spoke to him during February, during the independence days, he had withdrawn to a large degree from Sąjūdis activities and had founded a weekly newspaper. And he felt that there was a conflict between nationalism and democracy, at least a potential conflict, and that Sąjūdis had made a mistake by choosing nationalism and nationalist goals as its first priority and democracy as maybe its second priority. Now, the leaders of Sąjūdis would say that there is no conflict, that they can be both democratic and nationalistic. But I think that some people in Lithuania, and I suspect that I tend to agree with them, think that there is at least a potential for conflict between nationalism and democracy.
What is that conflict between nationalism and democracy?
Well, I think that when it comes down to it, the nationalists would be prepared to sacrifice democratic values, such as the right of a newspaper to criticize the nationalist leaders, if they felt that those democratic practices or democratic values threatened the national goals or the overriding national priority on securing independence. I think that the history of nationalist movements in Europe suggests that once those kinds of priorities are set and nationalism becomes the first priority as opposed to democracy, that the potential for dictatorship exists. And in fact, all three Baltic republics slid from democratic governments into authoritarian kinds of governments during the 1930s.
Do you think that nationalism sometimes goes along with a certain cultural chauvinism that can be anti-democratic, especially for the minorities living in the culture?
It certainly can, and I think that there are no end of examples where that can occur in the Soviet Union. It's a real hodgepodge of national groups which all have the opportunity now to assert their national identity and claim their national rights, and it quickly devolves into a kind of law of the jungle situation where every group is out to try to assert itself, to control its territory, and to, in some cases, dominate smaller groups within its sphere of influence.
Well, can you explain why is it that we are simultaneously seeing within the Soviet Union a move toward democracy and ethnic fighting?
Well, I think the principal reason is that under the old system in the Soviet Union, all kinds of political expression were prohibited. That included aspirations for human rights and democracy, and it also included things like anti-Semitism and national chauvinism. They were all repressed. Once you let the lid off, you can't decide that the kinds of expression you'll permit are the Andrei Sakharov kinds of expression and not the Pamyat kinds of expression. And both currents exist in Soviet thought.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more about Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. My guest is journalist Robert Cullen. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Journalist Robert Cullen is my guest, and he's been writing about Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union for The Atlantic and New Yorker magazines. Cullen was Moscow correspondent for Newsweek magazine, and he has a forthcoming novel based on his experiences there. It's called Soviet Sources, and it's due to come out next month. Let's talk a little bit about Romania. You just a couple of weeks ago had an article about Romania in The New Yorker magazine. Why wasn't there a bigger dissident movement in Romania?
Well, it's an interesting question, and it's one that I tried to answer when I was there last summer and again in January. And I think that there are a couple of reasons. One is rooted in Romanian history. For centuries, they were under the domination of the Ottoman Empire, and then under the domination of a rather corrupt and tyrannical aristocracy. And the people just developed the habit of submitting and not saying what they felt. Under Ceausescu, that was certainly the wisest way to live. I can tell you one story. When I went to Romania in August, I tried to be as inconspicuous as I could. I went on a tourist visa because it was difficult or impossible to get a journalist visa. And I didn't try to interview any dissidents until the very end of my stay there, when I went to see a man named Gabriel Andreescu, whose name had been given to me by a Romanian emigre organization, which assured me that while he might get in trouble for meeting with a foreign journalist, he probably would be better off for having attention paid to him. It would be some kind of protection for him if the authorities there knew that he had foreign contacts. So I went to his apartment, and I asked him that question, and he said there were several things. One, as I mentioned, was the tradition of submission, the culture of Romania. For instance, in Poland and in Hungary, the Catholic Church is the predominant religion. And the Catholic Church is an international organization that is not beholden to any particular government. In Romania, they have an Orthodox Church, which traditionally has submitted to the government of the country in which it exists, so that there's a Russian Orthodox, a Romanian Orthodox, a Greek Orthodox Church. And societies which have predominantly an Orthodox religion are not as prone, I don't think, to dissent as are those which have a Catholic or a Protestant tradition. And then he said there was the question of a very efficient, very Stalinist, and very thorough security apparatus. And I think it's the case that those countries in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union itself, which have had dissident movements, have not had them until such time as the Stalinist system relaxed somewhat and allowed people to begin to meet and express themselves. That's what gives rise to dissidents. And I found out exactly what he meant as soon as I left his apartment. Three or four security agents surrounded me, hustled me into a car, took me to a police station, searched me, took all my notes and my tape recording, and had me at the airport and on a plane out of the country within hours. They had kept his apartment under surveillance, and as soon as somebody came to see him, they got into action. So they kept that tight lid on the country. Andreescu, as it turned out, was also taken in for interrogation after he saw me and wound up being exiled to a small town about 100 miles from Bucharest. With that kind of security apparatus, you're not going to have much of a dissident movement. And that's, I think, the principal reason why Romania didn't.
You say that Romania proved that the Communist Party isn't invincible, and it was no coincidence that Gorbachev started the multi-party system in the Soviet Union after the fall of Ceausescu.
Mm-hmm.
Would you elaborate on that?
Well, I think that up until Romania, there was a sense that if the Communist Party in any communist society chose to shed blood in order to maintain its power, it could do so and maintain its power. I think that Romania showed that that's not the case. And I don't think that that example was lost on either the Soviet Army or on the Soviet Communist Party. I think it is an open question anymore as to whether if, for example, the Communist Party decided to either remove Gorbachev and impose a more conservative regime or to keep Gorbachev but get rid of perestroika and glasnost, whether A, the people would accept that the way they used to accept that sort of thing when, say, Brezhnev did it to Khrushchev, or whether the people would not go out onto the streets. And if the people go out onto the streets, I think it's an open question as to whether the army could be relied upon to maintain order and to shoot them if necessary to get them back into their houses and their factories.
Well, you actually raised a very interesting question in one of your articles. You said it's unclear now whether the Russians still possess the capacity for cruelty required for any political power, for any, like, large political power. What's changed? I mean, why, and who do you think needs to have that capacity for cruelty? Is it just the people at the top, or do the people in general have to condone that on some level for it to exist?
I think that both have to exist. I think that the people in general have to be convinced that there is some good reason for them to go out and shoot people if necessary to impose their system. I think that the rank-and-file soldiers in Czechoslovakia in 1968, for example, really thought that they were going into Czechoslovakia at the request of the socialist elements there to protect them from subversion or invasion by the capitalists. And therefore, they were prepared to shed blood if they had to in order to suppress the Czechoslovakian Prague Spring. The leadership has to believe that that will work, that their problems will be solved by the use of force. And I don't think that in either case the Russians are that confident anymore. I know that there appear to be two or three competing points of view within the Soviet elite. One point of view probably wishes at least that it could go back to the old style of doing things and suppressing dissidents by force. But I think that a much broader group of people within the Soviet elite now looks at other models of power and success. It used to be that an empire defined power and success for a country. But I think that the Soviets are well aware that the most successful countries in the world over the last 20 or 30 years have been Germany and Japan, which have not aggrandized themselves by conquering other countries or by adding to their territory, but have done it by achieving a high economic development level and a highly educated population with some cohesion to it.
Conquering markets instead of populations.
Conquering markets instead of population. And I know that that model appeals to a lot of Russians, and they realize that the old imperial model is counterproductive. And so I think that within the Soviet leadership, there are both elements. And I think that unless you're convinced that your model is correct and in the end best for everybody concerned, you're not going to be able to shed blood. The Russians are not naturally barbarians. They're decent people. And they were able to shed blood when they thought that in the end, communism would be best for the whole world. They don't think that anymore, and I don't think that they, at least, I don't think that all of them, or even a majority of them anymore, would be prepared to shed blood to impose their system. And once they're not prepared to shed blood, I don't think they can hold the system together.
Well, keeping the Soviet Empire together has become a very expensive proposition for the Soviet Union. Do you think that there are many political leaders and Soviet citizens who would just as soon see the Soviet Empire shrink a little bit for economic reasons?
Well, it's an interesting question. I spoke to a number of economists on my last trip to Moscow, and what appears to be the case is that under Brezhnev, before Glasnost, those economists who were able to figure out how much the empire was costing Moscow in terms of subsidized prices for oil and so forth, those people who had a sophisticated enough grasp of economics to know that, were suppressed to some degree. Not that they were put in jail, but their articles were not published, their opinions were not brought up to the level of the political leadership. Only after Glasnost were they able to put their point of view forth and to bring it to the attention of the leadership. So I think that within that sophisticated and progressive segment of the Soviet leadership, at least, they now understand how much the empire cost them, and that's one of the critical reasons why they were unprepared to try to stop the spinning away of the Eastern European satellites when it began to occur in 1988 and 89.
Journalist Robert Cullen is my guest. You were based in Moscow for some time as the Moscow correspondent for Newsweek. Are you sorry to be back in the States now that there's, you know, such earth-shattering events happening there all the time?
In some respects, yes, but in some respects, I think that it was a lot more pleasant to be a correspondent in Moscow in the time that I was there from 82 to 85 than it is now.
Pleasant in one sense, that there was more food or what?
No, not that. There was less news, and what you could get from the newspapers and from those limited contacts that were allowed with Soviet sources was manageable. Now there's so much going on and so much to write about that the correspondents in Moscow are working themselves to death. So I find that I have probably the best of both worlds. I can get over there fairly often in order to write about particular subjects that interest me. But I don't have to burn myself out the way I think that the steady correspondents over there have to do. It's really a rat race for them now. There's just so much there to do, so much that's available to write about that they're going all the time. The poker game that used to be a staple of life for the correspondents in Moscow every Thursday night doesn't exist anymore, as far as I know.
Everyone's too busy.
That's right.
Well, Robert Cullen, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Robert Cullen's articles on Eastern Europe have appeared in The Atlantic and The New Yorker magazine. He has an article on Lithuania coming out in the July issue of The Atlantic. He also has two forthcoming books. One's a novel called Soviet Sources, based on his experiences as the Moscow correspondent for Newsweek. The other is a nonfiction book of reporting on changes in the Soviet Union, and that will be called On the Edge of the Empire. The novel's coming out next month. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Political cartoonist Pat Oliphant can satirize a president with just a detail. During the Ford years, he added a Band-Aid to the president's forehead. While Ronald Reagan was in the White House, Oliphant put him in Alice in Wonderland's dress. Coming up, Pat Oliphant reflects on caricaturing six presidents. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker introduces us to the music of The Shoes. Ken says they may be the best thing to ever come out of Zion, Illinois. And film critic Stephen Schiff checks out those heroes in a half shell, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The Parliament of East Germany today elected the first non-communist government in its 40-year-long history. Bonn officials say they hope to start talks next week with a new East German government concerning economic and social aspects of German unity. Deidre Berger has this report.
The new East German Prime Minister, Lothar de Maizière, says the goal of his government is to work for a reunified Germany within a united Europe. The conservative prime minister told Parliament the new government will not forget its sense of social responsibility during the transition from a communist to a free market economy. The East German Parliament today passed a resolution recognizing the current German-Polish border as final and said the guarantee should be finalized by a united German Parliament. The East German delegates today also accepted responsibility for the Nazi past and apologized to Israel and the Jewish people for the former communist regime's failure to do so. The Parliament also apologized to the Czechs for the East German participation in the Warsaw Pact invasion of Czechoslovakia in 1968. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
Israel today welcomed East Germany's apologies to the Jewish people for the atrocities of the Nazi Holocaust. Patricia Golan reports from Jerusalem that among Israel's leaders, they are Holocaust survivors.
An Israeli foreign ministry statement called the East German declaration a significant and encouraging turning point in East Germany's attitude to the Jewish people in Israel. Today's session of East Germany's first democratically elected parliament marked the first time the country had ever formally accepted responsibility for the crimes against Jews. In the past, East Germany always refused responsibility for the Nazi Holocaust, saying that communists too had been victims. Many of Israel's political leaders are survivors of the Holocaust. House Speaker Dov Shilansky, a survivor of the Dachau concentration camp, said he would never grant forgiveness for the killing of Jews. I, who have been there and have seen with my own eyes what happened there, say that even in 1,000 years, the shame of Germany will not be erased. But other Israeli officials said the declaration could ease the way towards establishment of relations between the two countries. For National Public Radio, this is Patricia Golan in Jerusalem.
In Washington, U.S. Trade Representative Carla Hill said today that she hopes a new trade agreement with Czechoslovakia will be the first of many commercial treaties to help emerging democracies in Eastern Europe. The trade agreement that Hill signed today is the first that the United States has reached with a country in Eastern Europe since last year's political changes there. In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up 22 points to close at 2,751.80. on volume of 140 million shares. Advancing issues led declines more than 4-3. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. It's easy to understand why famous rock stars keep making music. There's all the adulation and there's the money. But what keeps a group going when they're not famous, don't have millions of fans, and don't make a lot of money? Rock critic Ken Tucker explores that question in his review of a new album by the band Shoes.
In this world that I'm sure of, but girl, I believe what I need now is your love. Oh, will you touch me with your eyes? The way you heat me up inside.
Like all the other Shoes records I've heard, this one arrived when I hadn't thought about the band in a long time. For all I knew, they'd broken up, abandoned the idea of reaching a sizable audience. And who could have blamed them? After more than a decade of creating superbly concise pop rock songs, they were less than a cult act. Yet here they were with 15 new songs on a compact disc called Stolen Wishes. Shoes consists of two brothers, John and Jeff Murphy, and their childhood friend Gary Klebe. When they started out in 1977, there was a fourth shoe, drummer Skip Meyer, but he quit after a few albums and they found a machine to do their drumming. The Murphys and Klebe all sing, play guitar and keyboards, and write songs. They all have voices that tend toward a high, reedy wail, and those voices are virtually indistinguishable. They live and work in Zion, Illinois, where they recorded their first album in their parents' living room. Eventually, they built their own studio in Zion, and that's where Stolen Wishes was recorded. That's Torn in Two, written by John Murphy. If you listen to a lot of Shoes music, you begin to distinguish between the trio's songwriting styles. They all favor Beatley love songs. In fact, the music resounds with 60s influences, from the Byrds to the Beau Brummels. But I tend to like John Murphy's songs the most, because underneath the brisk, chipper surface of the songs, this is a guy who really knows what it's like to be absolutely miserable in love. Shoes sent their first album out to lots of rock critics and sold it by mail order. It attracted enough raves to get the band signed to a major label, Elektra Records, where they recorded three excellent albums that went nowhere for the usual reasons. The times, which were punk rocky, were against them, and Elektra didn't promote them enough. Plus, they were remarkably stubborn about not wanting to tour and preferred to sit tight in Zion. I have no idea what their ideas were or are about all of this, but I do know just from their persistence and from listening to their music that they never succumbed to the usual flaws of cult acts. They never became bitter or insular or repetitive or self-conscious. We could never undo what's gonna be done. We could do it for love, or do it for fun. Thought you were stronger, tried to resist. You, I can't go wrong. So I don't know what to say, really. This is a great rock band that most people will never hear. And as long as they keep putting out an occasional collection, I honestly can't say that that's a bad thing. By now, it's clear that Shoes doesn't need fame or adulation to encourage them. Write me, and I'll give you the address so you can order their record. You'll really like it, I think.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. You can write him here at Fresh Air at 150 North 6th Street, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. This is Fresh Air. For 25 years and through six presidencies, political cartoonist Pat Oliphant has been satirizing American politics. He drew Jerry Ford with Band-Aids on his face. Jimmy Carter got smaller and smaller the longer he was in office. And Ronald Reagan became a John Wayne figure with a vacant Orphan Annie stare. Oliphant grew up in Australia, where he first began cartooning. He's now syndicated in 500 newspapers across the U.S., Oliphant is also a sculptor. An exhibit of his presidential cartoons and sculptures has just opened at the Smithsonian's National Portrait Gallery. Over 70 of Oliphant's cartoons of Ronald Reagan were just donated by the Kiplinger Foundation to the Ronald Reagan Library. Oliphant says he voted for Reagan twice.
There was no one else to vote for, and I felt disenfranchised. Besides, I voted for him because I needed him. When you got a subject that good, you don't want it to get away.
If, though, you vote for certain... No, I'm assuming that you didn't agree with his politics, but you liked him because he was fun to cartoon or interesting.
I liked
to
him as a subject, yes.
Yeah. Is that taking politics in a less than serious way if you just see it as something to cartoon as opposed to...
Well, it didn't really matter because I live in the District of Columbia and we're disenfranchised anyway. We just really have a vote that matters. And so it was something to do that day.
Do you usually vote for the person who you think will be the most interesting person to cartoon as opposed to who you think would be the best leader?
Not really. I should make that a policy, though, because everybody's got their own pack and that would be mine.
The cartoonist pack.
Yeah.
Now, you grew up in Australia.
Yeah.
What was cartooning like, political cartooning in the newspapers when you were coming of age?
In Australia?
Mm-hmm.
It was mainly, they mainly went for the gag. There was not any really hard-hitting or exploratory cartooning, especially in the more conservative papers, of which mine was one. And it was not much fun. Cartooning by committee, as it were. You have an editorial meeting every day and have this awful row of people hand-forging your cartoon for you out of a block of lead. And so I had to work around that, and I just drew what I could and invented a penguin called Punk that I used as a vehicle for my own thoughts and ideas, and that ran into the cartoon, and people liked it, so it couldn't be taken away.
Is that penguin the same as the character that still appears in the corner of your cartoons commenting on the action?
That's the same one, about 35 years old. And eventually, when I got out of having to mouthpiece other people's thoughts in my cartoons, I had two mouthpieces, so I had two, I had myself and my penguin, and so it became a double chore every day. You got to get one idea for the cartoon and then one idea for the penguin, so it was, but it's always been fun. It's always been a marvelous supplement, one to the other.
In 1964, you were hired by the Denver Post to be a political cartoonist there.
Right.
Why did they hire an Australian? It just seems so unusual to hire someone from another country to come and comment on your country's politics.
I thought so, too. But they seemed to, God bless them, and they wanted a different sort of, something different. Compared with Australia, it was a very free atmosphere and a free area of expression. And I started enjoying cartooning all over again. When I started to work in that was the Goldwater Johnson campaign. And it was such a lively scene in those days. It's been lively ever since, but to me, coming from Australia and dumping into the middle of that campaign was just like going to heaven.
What year was it that you started to work for the Washington Star?
1975. And I came there when they were the underdog. They were always the underdog, and they ended up dying being the underdog. But it was feisty and fun while it lasted.
Did you find that you had more visibility working for a Washington paper than
having your base
in Denver?
Mm-hmm. By then I was syndicated, and the visibility was pretty good anyway. It was nice to be in the nation's capital, though, and working, getting reaction from people you were drawing at a distance before. That doesn't mean that I hobnobbed with them at all. I don't believe that habit in the Washington Press Corps is a good one, where the press has started to become celebrities and hobnob with the enemy, as it were.
What's wrong with getting to know the people who you're writing about or cartooning about?
Well, you've seen it. You've seen what happens on the Sunday TV shows. You've seen these people become more celebrities than the people who they are interviewing. And so we're getting towards more and more towards news as entertainment, which we need less of, not more of.
Of the cartoons that you've done over the years, is there one or two that you could describe that caused the most ruckus, the biggest controversy?
I can't say the most controversy. I can think of some that stirred things up. When Carter first came into office, I drew a picture of the White House as having tires hanging from the trees and tires around the rose bushes and an outhouse out back and refrigerator and a junked car in the side yard. I heard from all over the South about that.
When you say that you heard from the South after the Carter photograph with the outhouse and the hanging tires.
Yeah.
People in the South thought that this was just stereotyping Southerners.
Yes, I had no idea they'd take it that way. It's always been a learning process, what you can stir up. And they were writing editorials down in Alabama, the headline of which was "Pray for Him."
In one of your campaign cartoons of Bush, you drew him the way he was being presented to the public as a bombardier, a real macho guy. And then you drew him as he was really perceived. And there he was, George Bush in a flowered dress and a lady's handbag.
Yeah.
What kind of response did you get to drawing George Bush in a dress with a handbag?
Well, he has supporters, I found. they took it for a while, and then I started to get letters, enough is enough. Stop drawing this man with his purse. Things like that. Well, you shouldn't say that sort of thing, because that'll just make me do more of it.
Did you get any angry letters from feminists who thought that it was insulting to women that to imply that somehow Bush was weak by putting him in a woman's clothes?
That's an odd thought. No, I didn't get that. It's, you think I should have?
Perhaps.
No, that wasn't a reaction.
As we were describing, you grew up in Australia. Your father was a draftsman, and from what I understand, you grew up without electricity, without running water. Was it for lack of money, or was it a preferred lifestyle that your parents wanted?
My parents moved to the hills outside Adelaide when I was very young, about 3 years old. They moved from the city to the hills because housing was scarce in the city, and this was the end of the Depression. We ended up as sort of newcomers in what you'd call a hillbilly area. with all those restrictions. But it wasn't unusual because all these people were living that way. And things got better over the years. We even got electricity eventually.
How did you start to draw?
Because my father was a draftsman for the government, I had an endless supply of pencils and paper. and also he had introduced me to political cartooning, or an interest in political cartooning when I was quite young. There was quite a tradition in Australia of, or was in those days, of black and white art, as we call it. Political expression was part of the thing I've always been interested in, that and drawing, and it seemed it's a great wedding of the two interests.
What are your preferred ways for keeping up with what's happening politically?
A lot of reading, watching television, because I've got to do cartoons on what other people have read or have seen, and it's a you're restricted in that way. You can't go off doing something esoteric on Italian politics or something that no one's ever heard about. You've got to do cartoons that on subjects that interest people and they know something about.
Is there a cartoon you're working on now?
Oh, I did something on the Mapplethorpe controversy in Cincinnati today. It's gone so far, and so it's become so ridiculous. There's no real room for discourse anymore. The sides have become so shrill. It's the same with the right to life abortion thing, or the right to die controversies. Everything gets so shrill at the end that you can't hear any conversation in the middle.
Can you describe the cartoon?
No, I don't like to describe cartoons. You've got to be there. But you could look for it in the local paper.
Okay. Pat Oliphant, thank you very much for talking
Thanks
to
very
us.
Much for having me.
Cartoonist Pat Oliphant. Oliphant's President's 25 Years of Caricature is showing at the Smithsonian's National Portrait Gallery. A companion book has been published by Andrews and McMeel. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. A story from London about what could be a huge rifle, the barrel of a huge rifle that belongs to Iraq. A report on the Salk polio vaccine 35 years after it was developed. The state of Kentucky has a new tax plan. It assures an equitable amount of money to educate every student, even in the poorest school district of the state. And we'll talk with David Lynch, the director and the co-writer of the new television series Twin Peaks. He describes the Northwestern look that he wanted for the series, and he goes back over a scene from Sunday night's pilot, a scene that involved lots of donuts and policemen.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. You guessed it, that's music from Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, the movie. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review.
Like many of you, I've been hearing entirely more than necessary about a certain previously unknown form of amphibian life. That's right, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle. And like many of you, I soon began to harbor a small but persistent curiosity about this creature, its anatomy, feeding and mating habits, geographical distribution, and so forth. Unlike most of you, however, it is my duty to pursue said curiosity, even unto the very movie theaters this life form inhabits. And so I have gone. I have seen, and I'm here to report that Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles are neither dangerous nor particularly entertaining. They are, however, here to stay, at least for the time being, since the movie that bears their name opened bigger than any other spring release in history. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, our Saturday morning cartoon show heroes, reincarnated on the screen as four guys in turtle suits, with animatronic heads invented by the people who brought us the Muppets. Once upon a time, we're told, some turtles in the New York sewers found themselves swimming in radioactive waste and emerged smart, humanoid, and alarmingly in love with pizza. A rat named Splinter, who had once been the pet of a ninja master, became their martial arts teacher. And now the turtles and the rat live in the sewers, emerging only to fight for truth, justice, and the American way. The mythology, as you can see, owes a lot to Star Wars and the Karate Kid. And the turtles themselves, though hard to tell apart, turn out to be nice blue-collar Italian Americans, who talk and gesticulate like so many little green Tony Danzas. And why, you may ask, do teenagers love them? Actually, they don't. The Ninja Turtles are aimed toward preteen boys, and well aimed at that. In the first place, the turtles are treated as unusual-looking creatures with whom the audience can sympathize. In short, they're some kind of ethnic minority group. The movie's a fantasy of empowering the powerless and respecting the despised. What could be more powerless than a turtle, more despised than a rat? So none of this can do kids any harm. And what does a preteen boy want in a fantasy figure? Well, he wants someone his age, or his big brother's age, who can also convincingly beat up on bad grown-ups. And he wants someone big enough to beat up on bad grown-ups who nevertheless isn't going to, like, get all mushy with a damsel in distress. The anatomical vagueness of a turtle completely fills the bill. The villain in this movie is a Darth Vader-like ninja who has recruited a gang of misunderstood teens to rob and vandalize New York City. This bad ninja is big and scary. Set him up against Corey Haim and Corey Feldman and all those other Coreys who are the usual teen heroes, and you'll never convince anyone that the kids can win. But give those Coreys a shell and green muscles and the speed and brilliance that only radioactive waste can impart, and you've got the makings of a monster hit. A hit that grown-ups can enjoy too? Frankly, no. Aside from the outlandishness of the concept and the extremely mild pleasure of watching a turtle employ the requisite preteen vocabulary, by which I mean excellent, radical, and righteous, the movie is colossally tedious. Send the kids. But a word of caution, 1/2 hour before they return home, you'd better prepare yourself. You're going to need pizza, and you're going to need a lot of it.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Thad Kirk, and Dan Laughlin. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
He has Elvis Costello's old rhythm section, Van Morrison's keyboardist, the Everly Brothers guitarist, and a name from a Bob Dylan song. On the next Fresh Air, we meet singer, songwriter, and guitarist John Wesley Harding. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.